Rishus, Rabbi Muscat, and my parents. So because it's Tisha B'Av, we're not supposed to enjoy ourselves learning Torah. Even when we learn a topic that's a permitted topic, it's not supposed to be enjoyable. It's not supposed to have the depth that we would usually associate with Talmud Torah. So we need to keep this relatively narrowly focused on Tisha B'Av topics. There are lots of things here that could be taken in other directions and included for another time. We're going to be talking about the failings of earlier generations, and I just want to mention two risks that entails. Number one, the risk of judging people we never met. We're working with the evidence conveyed in Tanakh and in Medrash, but with the understanding that we don't really know the individuals we are describing. We're working based on our narrative tradition of what happened in Tanakh, what happened in the time of the Churban. But that's one of the risks, is that we're judging people we never met. The other risk is a lack of empathy for their suffering. The Gemara I mentioned in Elit Zion, in my introduction to Elit Zion, that the Gemara talks about cities that didn't grieve for Yerushalayim. The grandson of Rav Shlomo Kluger, Rav Shlomo Kluger was the great Rav in Brod. His grandson was also named Shlomo Kluger. But he lost both his parents at a young age. And in the hesped for the death of his father, it's printed in his Sefer Siach Shlomo, he asks, how is it that you couldn't mourn for Yerushalayim? How could it be? There were great cities with great tzaddikim in them. Kfar Sachnia is mentioned in the Gemara in Gittin as being so righteous. How could they not mourn for Yerushalayim? And his answer was very insightful. His answer was, because we spend so much time on the flaws that led to the destruction, that it becomes easy to sort of excuse it and to say, well, okay, they had it coming to them. Not necessarily in that stark and harsh a way, but to say, well, they were guilty of sinas chinam, and they were guilty of gil arayos shvichas dam avrazar. And the result of that can be a lack of empathy for them, which is a terrible thing. So I just wanted to note that, because we are going to be talking about mistakes and problems that led to devastation. I call this shiur a matter of trust, and you need to define trust. Can anyone give me a definition of trust? What does trust mean? We all know what it is, right? But defining it is not so simple and straightforward. There's, I found an essay called What is Trust by Dr. Paul Faggard, in which he talks about, I brought it in source number one on the sheet, he's talking about how we experience trust. And he says, well, you could call trust a set of behaviors, right? Behaviors where you act in a way that shows you depend on somebody else. Or you could call it a belief. You believe that a person is going to behave in the ways that you expect them to behave. Or it's an abstract mental attitude towards the proposition that somebody is dependable. It's a little too abstract for me. A feeling of confidence and security that a partner cares. It's an emotion. It's a feeling. So Faggard's goal in his essay is to get towards what's going on in the brain, the neural process involved in trust. But I think that whether you describe trust as a behavior, a belief, an attitude, an emotion, a feeling, I think the bottom line is, and I put it in number two as my working definition, trust is when we have the confidence that somebody is going to honor expectations, their commitments, their relationships, their shared values, even if doing so would conflict with what they really want. They're reliable. I can rely on them that they said they're going to do X, they're going to do X, and even if they don't want to, they're going to do it anyway. That's what trust is about, right? Is that a fair definition that works? If not, you can say so. I don't mind. So this relates in a very big way to Tisha B'Av. The first Tisha B'Av was when? When's the first observance of Tisha B'Av?
When the spies
Right, the story of the Meraglim, the Gemara in Tanis. I brought it in source number 3, the Mishnah in Tanis that lists the 5 things that that are the core events of Tisha B'Av. The first one is B'Tisha B'Av Nigzar Al Avosenu Shel Yikansu La'aretz. It was decreed on our ancestors they would not enter Eretz Yisrael. Menalan, and the Gemara asks, how do you know that that's so? How do you know that happened on Tisha B'Av? The Torah does not say. And on the 9th of Av or on the 8th of Av they returned. And it goes through a whole bunch of psukim, which I didn't bring on here, where they try to demonstrate that you can figure out that it actually was Tisha B'Av. And then they follow it up by saying, the nation raised their voices, and they cried that night, and Rabbah quotes Rabbi Yochanan to say, Osa Laila Leil Tisha B'Av Haya, that was the night of Tisha B'Av. The Amar leMakadosh Baruch, when Hashem said to them, "Atem bechisem bechia shalchinam vani kovei alachem bechia ledoros," you cried for nothing. I am going to establish for you crying for generations. The first Tisha B'Av is when we accepted the bad report about Eretz Yisrael brought by the Meraglim. So, how would you logically connect the story of the Meraglim with a lack of trust? Where's the connection? Right, trust in God, right? You sent spies in the first place because you didn't trust in Hashem. Also, along with that, trust in Moshe, right? A lack of trust. Moshe was the one who told them way back when, in God's name, that this is a land, Zavas Chalav Udvash, flowing with milk and honey. But there's another lack of trust that's highlighted by the difference between these Meraglim and the Meraglim Yehoshua sent in the second parak of Sefer Yehoshua. The Jews are on the brink of entering Eretz Yisrael. And Yehoshua sends spies across the Yarden into the major city of Yericho. How many spies did Yehoshua send? 2. How many spies did Moshe send? Well, 12 maybe. Rabbi Akiva in the Yerushalmi actually says 24. It's a whole fascinating thing. He says that there are 12, and then, and there are 12. There are actually 24 spies. Sorry? Right, so it wasn't with their wives. The Kli Yakar, you laugh, but the Kli Yakar actually has a comment in Parsha Shlach that the reason why it went bad was because they sent men. Had they sent women, it would not have happened. That's not a joke. That's the Kli Yakar's comment. But in terms of the 12 versus the 2, it makes sense to send just 2 spies. Right? It's less obvious, right? As you say, it's less obvious. It's, you know, it's just a small group. They can get in, get out, right? Why in the world does Moshe send 12 spies? Radak actually says that Yehoshua sends 2 because of the debacle the first time. He says Yehoshua wants to keep the mission secret from the Jews. When he sends the spies, the Jews don't know. And that way, if they come back with some terrifying message, or if they don't make it back at all, no one will be any the wiser. So he sends just 2 spies and nobody is aware. Abarbanel says he sends 2 spies also as a reaction to the first time, because this way they'd have a weaker voice if they said bad things. When you have 10 spies saying bad things, you win people over. If just 2 spies and they say bad things, okay, so they say this and I say that, and maybe you can still salvage things. But sending 12 doesn't make sense in the first place. It's not an efficient way to do it. Not to mention, how do they send 12? How do they choose the 12? Sorry? One per shevet, right? One per tribe. Is that really the way you do it, right? When you want to pick people for your mission, you pick the best qualified, right? This gets into the whole college admissions thing, right? You're choosing people not based on their abilities, but because they're from the right shevet. I need somebody from Zebulun, so I'm going to take someone from Zebulun, even if there's a better one from Naphtali. That doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? Why would you pick one per tribe?
Equity.
Buy in from everybody. You want to make sure that everybody is going to feel like they are represented in the final group. That's why you do it. So the Malbim makes a fascinating point on Yehoshua. Take a look at source number 5. Malbim says, Yesh baze shnei minei shlichus. He says there are two kinds of missions. Im ha'am sholchim tarim, l'roz ha'tova im ra'ah. He borrows the word from Parshas Shlach with Moshe's miraglim. If the nation sends tarim to scout out, is it good, is it bad? Shakavana baze im yirusha yilchmu aleha im lav. The intention being to see, should we fight or not? Should we go or not? Yishlechu nasi mikol shevet. Then you send a nasi from each tribe. Kilo yismechu bazel anashim chusim lo yismechu shevet al shaliach shevet acher. Number one, they won't rely on lesser men. Has to be the leaders. But number two, because each shevet will not rely on the shaliach of the next shevet. Ki kol echad yishlach ish asher yismoch li bo alav. Because each one wants to know, is the land good for my shevet? We have unique traits. I want to know, is this good for my shevet, for Naphtali? I don't care if it's good for Asher. I want to know, is it good for me? Kifi mashu, oved adama, some of them work the land, o roet zon, or they're shepherds, o seik b'mischar, they're involved in trade, o lechof aniyos, or they go to sea. Lo cheinim sholchem miragel, as opposed to if you send a miragel, the only word used for Yehoshua's spies, it doesn't say tarim. V'hu im hiskimu lechavsha, that's where they've already decided we're going to conquer the land. V'sholchem l'ros eservas ha'aretz me'ezem akom yechbeshua bekal. They just want to know what's the best way into the land. They want to know how can we find the spot that's hidden from which we can access it. Then yishlachu ish achad o shnayim mehamonam. Then you send just one or two from the nation. Kizeh yishlach rak sarat tzava. Because you send military officers. It's not a diplomatic mission. And the key to me, aside from his point, which is that Moshe is sending people to decide whether to go in, whether it's worth it. And Yehoshua is sending people to decide how to go. But the key line that catches my eye is that the Shvatim don't trust each other's emissaries to look after their priorities and needs. Because that's so the story of Jewish history. It's the story in Tanakh, right? Sefer Shoftim starts really well. When they're going to start to conquer the land, Yehuda and Shimon work together to conquer land as a team. But the lack of trust results in groups looking after their own interest and taking advantage of each other, so that just a few prakim later we get the story of Devorah, right? Devorah trying to lead the Jews to fight against Canaan, and the tribes that are under the thumb of Canaan are the ones who fight. But in Perek Hey in Shoftim, Devorah says, this one didn't come, and this one didn't come, they were hanging out with their sheep, they're not here. They're not willing to support each other. And then you get towards the end of Shoftim, and you get the story of Shimshon. Shimshon is from the tribe of Dan. And Shevet Yehuda turns Shimshon over to the Plishtim. And then you get the story of Pelegesh B'Giva, where the Jews of the city of Giva do this horrible thing, right? This horrible molestation of a Pelegesh, and she dies. And the rest of the Shvatim come in, and Binyamin, the tribe of Binyamin in which Giva is located, instead of saying, yes, help us punish the people of Giva, they view it as an assault on their autonomy, how dare you, and they defend Giva, going to war against everybody else. The split of Yehuda and Yisrael, which would result ultimately in two kingdoms, that starts much earlier. That's found already, I mean, obviously it starts with Yosef and his brothers, you can go all the way back to that. But the actual split is found when Shaul becomes king. Because Shaul's first act as king is to go to war against Ammon. Ammon is threatening the people of Yavesh Gilad. And he takes a census of the soldiers that he has, and they count separately the soldiers of Yehuda and the soldiers of Yisrael. Yehuda and Yisrael are already split in Sefer Shmuel. Tisha B'Av has its roots in a mission that begins when we don't trust in Hashem, yes, and we don't trust Moshe, yes, and we also didn't trust each other. That's the starting point. And that lack of trust in each other continues throughout both Batei Mikdash. Bayis Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash, we just mentioned the split of Yehuda and Yisrael, so that you end up with the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. You know, when I learned about that for the first time as a kid, it was fairly antiseptic. It was just, okay, now there were two kingdoms. There had been one, and now there are two kingdoms. And okay, so Yisrael in the north, they're really bad. They descend into idolatry, and they descend into coups against the king. And Yehuda, kind of up and down, some better, some worse. That skips the terrible wars between them. It wasn't just a matter of, so there are Jews living here and there are Jews living there. Take a look at source number 6. I brought you from Divrei HaYamim Beis. Aviah, the son of Rechavam. When the split originally happens, in the time of Rechavam and Yeravam, there is almost a war between them. And Hashem sends a Navi and says, don't do it, don't fight. However, the next generation, there's a war. And look at what you see here. And Aviah and his army struck them mightily, 500,000 chalalim, corpses of Yisrael. 500,000 Jews killing other Jews. It keeps on going. Yeshaya talks about this. It's in the Haftarah that's read on Yom Kippur, in source number 7. He says, why are you fasting? This is Malbim's read of the Pasuk. You fast in order to fight, to torment, to strike with a wicked fist. Those who have power take advantage of those who do not. The lack of trust and trustworthiness is seen on the institutional level as well. They didn't trust the Nevi'im. Yirmiyahu gets terribly abused. I brought you samples in source number 8 from Sefer Yirmiyahu. Pashur struck Yirmiyahu, the prophet. He placed him upon the stocks at the upper gate of Benjamin in the house of God. And they took Yirmiyahu and they threw him into the pit of Malkiyahu, the prince, in the yard of imprisonment. They lowered Yirmiyahu in ropes. There was no water in the pit, but only clay, and Yirmiyahu sunk into the clay. This is what happens to the great Navi Yirmiyahu. That's Bayis Rishon. That's the first Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash doesn't start well. Nehemiah shows up from Persia, seeking to make things better, to build up the walls, to defend Yerushalayim. And he finds that there is economic suffering among the Jews. There are Jews who don't have, and they are being taken advantage of by those who do have. If you take a look at source number 9, the cries of the nation and their wives were great to their Judean brothers. Some of them said, we have given our sons and daughters for interest payments, to buy grain, to eat and live. Some said, we have given our fields, vineyards, and houses as collateral to buy grain in the time of hunger. They are suffering at the hands of other Jews. That's the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. In source number 10, I brought you the story of of Chonyo and Shimi, or one version of the story. There are two versions in the Gemara, but I felt one was sufficient. When he was dying, Shimon HaTzadik said, my son Chonyo shall serve in my place as Kohen Gadol. I'm just reading my English translation. You can see the original Hebrew there as well. Chonyo's brother Shimi, who was 2.5 years older than Chonyo, was jealous. He said to Chonyo, I will teach you the order of the service. I'll teach you how to do the avoda. He dressed Chonyo in a leather tunic, and he girded him with an ornamental belt, and he led him to the altar, and then he told the other Kohanim, look what he did. That was a promise he made to his girlfriend. See what this one vowed and fulfilled for his beloved. On the day I will serve as high priest, I will wear your leather tunic and ornamental belt. He sets him up. And the other Kohanim want to kill Chonyo. He flees. They pursue him, and he goes to Alexandria in Egypt. That was Rabbi Meir's version of the story. Rabbi Yehuda flipped the version of flipped the story somewhat. But either way, the story remains the same, which is Chonyo ends up fleeing to Egypt. What ends up happening with his flight to Egypt? Right, he ends up building a breakaway Beis HaMikdash in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. Then you have the Gemara, which appears in Bava Kamma. It also appears in Sota, in source number 11. Moving ahead in time, to the fights between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus for power. They were members of the house of the Chashmonoim. The first Chashmonoim were wonderful. We sing about them on Hanukkah. And then after that, they become Hellenized. And this is a demonstration of the disaster they descend into. Our sages taught, again, I'll just read out my English translation, but you can see the original. When the members of the Hasmonean house besieged each other, Hyrcanus was inside in Yerushalayim, Aristobulus was outside, and the people inside would lower a box of dinarim out each day, and those outside would send up the daily offerings. An elder there who knew Greek wisdom said, as long as they are involved in the service, they will not be given into your hands. The Greek wisdom is a whole other element of the story, not for Tisha B'Av. The next day, the people inside lowered a box of dinarim, and those outside sent up a pig. The Maharsha says this is a reference not to a pig, it's a reference to Rome. I'll come back to that in a moment. When it reached the midpoint of the wall, it stabbed its nails into the wall, and Israel shook 400 parsa by 400 parsa. At that time, they declared a curse against those who raise pigs and who teach their children Greek wisdom. Again, a part of the Gemara that's really for a different time. But the point here is the Rome piece of it. Because this is already when the Romans have risen in power. And if you are part of a feud for power in Judea, and you don't have the upper hand over the other, you can't defeat the other, you go looking for an ally. And they bring in Rome as their ally. That's the reference to sending a pig into Jerusalem. And the result is that Rome gains greater influence. And then, of course, you have the Gemara in Yuma in source number 12. The Gemara that talks about the reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And it tells us there, the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shfichus Damim, idolatry, immorality, and bloodshed, and it brings psukim to try to support each of those. And in the second Beis HaMikdash, they say, no, people were involved in Torah and mitzvos, acts of chesed, so why was it destroyed? Sinas chinam, baseless hatred. To which they then ask, but that was in the first Beis HaMikdash also, and they bring you a pasuk of Yechezkel that shows that the Jews were lashing out against each other in the first Beis HaMikdash as well. To which they say, yeah, but that was talking about the leaders. Now it was the rank and file. Now it was everybody in the second Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't just the people who were fighting for power. My point in bringing this is to say that the lack of trust and trustworthiness, because they go together, it's seen in the first Beis HaMikdash, and it's seen in the second Beis HaMikdash. Why is this so important? Why is it so important that we have that trust? Why is that so vital? Why is it necessary? Sounds like a silly question, but there's a reason to ask it. Why is it so necessary? Besides being a nice thing. Yeah.
Prevents fighting.
Right, well, let's start on the personal. Yeah, Mendy.
Foundation of society.
Foundation of society, right. So I'm going to come back to the foundation of society and the practicality, but first on a very personal level. A person who is afraid to trust spends his life looking for negatives in other people in order to justify his cynicism. Right? If I don't trust people, I need to find a way to justify that. And the way I justify it is saying, well, I don't trust him because he does this wrong. I don't trust him because there was something that happened with him whenever it was. That's number one. Number two, a person who can't trust others comes to justify personal impropriety because he sees fault in others and he justifies it then in himself because everybody's doing it. All those people are bad people. So if they're doing it, I can do it as well. And then, yes, the practical point on the communal level. Society needs trust. If you take a look at number 13, I brought you from Francis Fukuyama. I thought he framed it very well. On the economics of trust, he says, a nation's well-being as well as its ability to compete economically is conditioned by a single pervasive cultural characteristic, the level of trust inherent in the society. You need that in order to be able to work together, in order to be able to create something. Number 14, virtually all economic activity from running a laundry to building the latest generation microprocessor is carried out not by individuals, but by organizations that require a high degree of social cooperation. As economists argue, the ability to form organizations depends on institutions like property rights, contracts, and a system of commercial law, but it also depends on a prior sense of moral community, that is, an unwritten set of ethical rules or norms that serve as the basis of social trust. If we don't trust each other, then we can't build anything. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein made this point during the fights at the time of the disengagement. It's source number 15. The journal Tradition printed an exchange of letters from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and the son-in-law of Avram Shapira about the issue of disobeying orders in the IDF when they were ordered to help carry out the expulsion of Jews from Gaza. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was against disobeying orders. He felt that the soldiers should not disobey orders. And one, well, you'll see it here. He doesn't need me to speak for him. Source number 15, he says, with respect to values and principles that divide Israeli society, regarding which there is no consensus defining a particular initiative as patently illegal and immoral, selective refusal of orders is impossible. He says, as long as there are multiple views, as long as you can't say definitively that I know this is wrong, as long as there is another point of view, he says, choosing to refuse orders is impossible. Refusal on the right invites refusal on the left, and vice versa. And look where we are. The result is a divided and disjointed army, part of which dissents and abstains from an initiative in one direction, and the other rejects initiatives in the opposite direction. Who knew he was a Navi? The damage to the unity and cohesion of the army and to the readiness for mutual dedication and sacrifice is clear. And as a result, the IDF's ability to carry out its missions and its power of deterrence are eroded. One need not be a great general or statesman to understand the possible implications. He saw it. We need it. We need the trust on a personal level. We need the trust on a communal level. And we need the trust on a spiritual level, because it enables trust in Hashem. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. And this is why Torah generally, not exclusively as we'll see, but generally supports trust. Take a look at source number 16 as an example, the Gemara in Shabbos. Hachoshed b'ksherim loka b'gufo. One who suspects people who are righteous, you suspect somebody of something and they're not wrong. They didn't do what you thought they did. That person will suffer bodily harm. As seen from Moshe, d'chsivehem lo ya'aminu li. Moshe says to Hashem, the Jews aren't going to believe me. V'galya kame kutshabrichu d'behem ne'yisrael. But Hashem knew that the Jews would believe. Amar lo, and Hashem said, hey ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. They are believers, they are descendants of believers. Va'ata ein sovcha la'amin. You are the one who will not believe. Hein ma'aminim, they believed, d'chsivehem ha'am. The pasuk says, they in fact did believe. B'nei ma'aminim, descendants of believers, that's Avraham, v'he'emin b'Hashem. The first time the Torah uses the word emuna is that pasuk, when Avraham believes in Hashem, when Hashem promises that he will have descendants. Then he doesn't believe, it appears, and that's a whole other piece to that story. But Ata in sovcha l'ha'amin, Moshe, you won't believe? That's when he hits the rock. Shne'amar ya'an lo he'emantem bi, you did not believe me. And how do we know that Moshe was harmed because of this? Mimai delaka? Dichsiv, because the pasuk says, Vayomar Hashem lo, od haveina yadcha b'cheikecha. Hashem said to Moshe again, put your hand inside, or said to him, put your hand inside again. And his hand comes out, and he has sara'as. So Moshe didn't believe. Moshe did not trust the Jews. And the result was that he is struck with sara'as. Now there you could argue, the line in the Gemara is about hachoshed b'ksherim. If you suspect good people, okay, so I have an obligation to trust good people, but I don't have an obligation to trust everybody. But it's not true, because the line in Pirkei Avos says, "Have a done es kol ha'adam lekav zichus." And there is that nice Dvar Torah that people give, Kol Ha'adam means the entire person, but that's not the literal meaning. The literal meaning of the line in the Mishnah is, judge every person favorably. The trust is for everyone. And Ad Kedei Kach, it goes so far. Take a look at source number 17. Look at the Rambam. The Rambam's talking about a judge. We're talking to a judge, really. And he says, Bo lefonecha shnayim. Two parties come before you. Echad kosher, the echad rasha. One of them is kosher. One of them you know to be wicked. Al tomar hoil v'rasha hu v'cheskaso mishaker. Don't say, well, since this guy's wicked, and he's known as a liar, v'chezkazeh she'eno mishana bidvaro, and this other one, on the other hand, is known not to speak falsely, ate hadin ala rasha, I'll tilt the verdict against the wicked one. He says, you're not allowed to do that. So writes the Rambam. Rav Yosef Abad, the Minchas Chinuch, comments on this in source number 18, and he says, why? Da Torah hizhira shalo tachzik harasha l'shakran bish'as hadin. The Torah warns, you're not allowed to assume that the wicked person is going to be a liar in court. Ela shneim shavin, the two are equal. Umitzar hasvara hayarashai, d'chezkasa mishaker. Logically, it makes sense for the judge to say, this guy's a no-goodnik. Why in the world should I believe anything he says? Doesn't work that way. HaTorah is hira alzeh. The Torah says you're not allowed to do that. Trust is apparently something that everybody is entitled to. And not just every individual, but institutions. The Navi. We have a mitzvah of trusting the Navi. We're supposed to listen to the Navi. Lo sasur. You're not allowed to stray from the words of the Chachamim. So if I stop here, we'd say, very simple and straightforward, Tisha B'Av starts with a lack of trust for Hashem, for Moshe, and for each other. That's how we end up with the 12 spies. The lack of trust persists in the era of the Shoftim, the first Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash. And it's bad because we're supposed to trust. But you have to look deeper because it's not that simple. It's not that simple. It's not that straightforward. Trust is a little bit more complicated than that. The complication of trust begins in source number 19, Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu says, so declares Hashem, Arur hagever asher yivtach ba'adam. Cursed be the man who trusts in people, placing flesh as his strength. From God his heart strays. You trust people, you stop trusting God. Baruch HaGever Sheivtach Bashem. Blessed be the man who trusts in God. Now suddenly I'm not supposed to trust. We spent the last, half an hour saying that we should trust, but Yirmiyahu doesn't think so. Yirmiyahu thinks that we're not supposed to trust. Why does that make sense? Why should we not trust? What are the reasons for not trusting people? I heard someone say experience. They're imperfect. First of all, we're imperfect because we have limited capacity to help. Right? The pasuk that's in Tehillim that said in Psukei Dezimra, source number 20, Al tiftachu v'nedivim, do not trust princes, a son of man who cannot save. His spirit leaves him and he returns to the earth. Human beings, even if they have the best of intentions, can't necessarily help you. But more, human beings are imperfect and they are not trustworthy. You get this line at the end of the Gemara in Sota, which describes the generation in which Mashiach will come. And one of the hallmarks of the generation is that people cannot trust each other. Chutzpah yasge, chutzpah will increase. Oive ish anshe beso. One's enemies will be his own household. Pnei hador ki pnei hakelev. The face of the generation will be the face of the dog. A reference to chutzpah and disrespect. Haben eno misbayesh me aviv. The son will not be embarrassed before his father. Va'ama yesh lanu lehisha ein. Upon what can we depend? Only al avinu shabashamayim. On our father in heaven. Nobody else will be dependable. The Meseches Derech Eretz, one of the added mini-mesechtos for Shas, source number 22. La'olam yiyu kol b'nei adam be'einecha kelistim ve'hevei mechabdon kerabin gamliel. If you've heard the line, kabdeyu v'chashdehu, honor people and yet be suspicious, that's an outgrowth of this. People should be like bandits in your eyes and honor them like Rabban Gamliel. I don't know where Don Lekav's chus just went. Because he also says it about everybody. Even the institutions that we said before, you're supposed to trust the Navi, and we said you're supposed to trust the Sanhedrin. Not so fast. As far as the Sanhedrin, take a look at source number 23. The Hebrew's on one side, the English is at the top of the next side. Horu Beis Din Bishgaga. If Beis Din gives a ruling that is incorrect, they make a mistake. V'yadu akal shatahu, and people in the community know that it was a mistake. V'shein roi lekabel mehen, and that it's inappropriate to rely on them. V'ava b'kein asu akal apiyam, but they do it, because the Beis Din said, it's not my problem. The Beis Din said it, so I can do it. Eilu ve'elu peturim min akarbon. So neither of them brings a karbon. Normally there's a karbon when Beis Din makes a mistake. That doesn't apply here. The Beis Din doesn't have to bring a karbon because the reason the people did it was not because they were tricked. It wasn't that they were fooled. They knew full well. And all the people who follow the Beis Din don't bring a karbon either. Why? Because they don't qualify for a karbon. Because it's intentional. They knew that the Beis Din had made a mistake. They knew that they shouldn't be following them. So if you know Beis Din is wrong, then you're not supposed to say, I put my trust in the Beis Din. And the same thing is true regarding the Navi. The same principle applies regarding the Navi in source number 24. Im yomar lanu anavi shenoda lanu shehu navi. Lavor al achas mikol mitzvos amuros betorah. If somebody who is already known to be a Navi, he speaks the word of Hashem, he promotes the Torah, he comes to us and he says to us, I want you to violate one of the mitzvos. Oh, a mitzvos harbe, or many mitzvos, ben kalos, ben chamuros, light mitzvos, more severe mitzvos, lefi sha'ah, to do it temporarily, then mitzvah l'shmo'alo, then you listen to him. And we have examples of that in Tanakh, of Nevi'im doing that. The classic example is Eliyahu on Har HaKarmel. Eliyahu sets up a mizbeach and brings a karbon on Har HaKarmel, even though there is a Beis HaMikdash, when you're not allowed to bring a karbon outside the Beis HaMikdash. But Eliyahu says to do it, and it seems like he's right. V'chein lamadnu mechachamim rishon epi ha-shmua, and so we have learned from our sages by tradition, b'chol im yomar lecha anavi avor al divrei Torah ke Eliyahu bar HaKarmel shmalo, in every time that the Navi tells you to violate it, you listen to him, chutz me'avodas kochavim, other than idolatry. If the Navi says to worship idols, then you don't do it. And then he continues to say, though, Voshia davar lefi sha'a, only if the order is temporary. If he says to you to do it in an ongoing way, then you don't listen to the Navi. We said you have to trust the Navi, do what the Navi says. Yeah, not always. So trust is a little more complicated. On the one hand, we promote it, and we say that we've collapsed when we didn't have it. And on the other hand, trusting human beings can be harmful because humans have failings, because humans are inadequate. So what does God want me to do? Does he want me to trust or doesn't he want me to trust? Do I follow Yirmiyah? Like what am I supposed to do? So again, you know, if this were in Tisha B'Av, there would be a lot more that we could, you know, expand on and say and discuss and analyze, but I want to offer something that I think is straightforward. The answer is to trust, knowing that it has a price. In the logic of psychology, trust is an and, not a but. You're gonna suffer for it, and you do it. It's dangerous, and it's a good thing to do. It wasn't always so in Jewish history. Rav Zalman Sirotzkin, in his Haggadah, contends that Hashem actually chose our ancestors because they didn't trust. Right? He got what he paid for. But he chose them because they didn't trust. Abraham fights with his family. He fights with Nimrod, as the Medrash brings on Ur Kasdim. He fights with Lot. Yitzchak fights the Plishtim. Yaakov resists the ways of Lavan and his family. Yosef and his brothers divide up into three different groups, right? You have the Shvachos, and you have Yosef, and you have the others. Even Yehuda doesn't last as their leader. Vayered Yehuda me'es echav. They all fight. The Gemara in Beitza says the Jews are Azin Shabaumos. We are the boldest of the nations. Says Rav Zalman Saratskin, it's necessary. We needed that. Because otherwise we would have been like everybody else. Our whole world is idolatrous, so we'll just go with the flow. We needed to not be trusting in the beginning. The problem is that at some point you have to outgrow that. There's an immaturity involved. And at a certain point you have to outgrow that. Rav Zalman Saratskin felt that was the goal of the experience in Egypt. He said if you take flour and you expose it to water, then it spreads apart. That's chametz. Whereas if you don't let it rise, it becomes matzah. Chametz, it grows apart. Matzah has a tight bond. He said we were supposed to develop that tight bond in Mitzrayim. That was, he believes, the goal. Rav Saratskin, in saying that we're supposed to trust and we're supposed to develop that bond, is well aware of the Torah's warnings about trust failing us. But he still promotes it. Because trust is a personality trait. And it's a trait that we need. It's really a trait that's necessary. I go back to the Gemara in Shabbos that I referenced before in source number 16. Did you notice what God calls the Jewish people when he's talking to Moshe? He says, we are ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. Not just that we are ma'amin, not just that we believe, but that we are ma'aminim. We are believers. It's a hallmark trait of ours. And that can be bad, because we can be fooled. And it can be hard. We need to learn it. But it's valuable. It's valuable for all the reasons that we gave before. Right? I wanted to spell out all the benefits. It's valuable for us to learn to trust, even when experience says that it's not going to go in our favor. Because if we don't, then we look for negatives everywhere. If we don't, we justify bad behavior in ourselves. If we don't, we can't build a society. We can't have corporations. We can't have an army. And ultimately, we can't have trust in God either. We need it in order to be able to trust in Hashem. If I'm not a trusting person when it comes to other people, I'm not going to flip a light switch and then suddenly become a trusting person when it comes to God. It doesn't work that way. You need to have the trust as a trait in order to be able to trust in Hashem. So to summarize what we've said, Moshe sends 12 spies because each Shevet doesn't trust the other to take their concerns seriously. Bayis Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash, has civil war. The wealthy harming the needy. Lack of trust in the Nevi'im. Bayesheni, wealthy versus the indigent, battles over power, sinas chinam on the local level, and we need that trust, we need that trait of trust. It's a necessity for us. But one last note. We are not the only ma'aminim. Hashem is also a ma'amin. Not yet Chatzos. Chatzos is 1 o'clock. You shouldn't express hope at all before Chatzos. Nonetheless, Hashem is also a ma'amin. We see it before the Torah even begins. Take a look at source number 25, Gemara in Sanhedrin. Remarkable Gemara. There are midrashim that are like it. Elsewhere, I just brought this one. Rabbi Yehuda quotes Rav. When Hashem wanted to create human beings, he created a group of ministering malachim, and he said, should we do it? Right? Nasa Adam. The literal meaning of Nasa Adam is, let us make man, us meaning the royal we. God is saying, should I make man? But we know Nasa sounds plural. And so the Gemara says, yeah, Hashem is talking to the malachim that he created. Hashem said to them, should we do it? Amru lefana ribonishal olam amasav. And they asked God, well, what do human beings do? Samalan kachma kachmasav. Hashem gave them the experience. He showed them human history. So Amru lefanav, they said, what would you do that for? Ribonishal olam ma'enosh kisiz kirenu ben adam kisif gedenu. What is man that you are, that you would remember him? Why would you do that? Hoshet etzba'o ketana b'neihem b'sarfam. So Hashem sticks out his finger and he burns them. V'chein kas shniyah does the same thing with the second group. Maybe that's where Michelangelo got the idea of the hand, right? The finger is sticking. Maybe it came from that. I don't know. Then the second group, he does that also. Kas shlishis, the third group, amru lefanav, they said to God, Ribono shel olam, rishonim sha'amru lefanecha maho ilu. They said to God, look, you know, the first group you destroyed. The second group you destroyed. So what are we supposed to do here? Kol olam kulo shelchahu, the whole world belongs to you. Do what you want. What are you asking us for? Then along come the generations that God foresaw, the generation of the mabul of the flood, the generation of the dispersion. And Amulafan of the Malachim said to God, "I told you so," which I would think would be a dangerous thing to do. But they said, "Ribono shel olam, lo yafa amru rishonim lefanecha." Weren't these Malachim right? And Amar Lahem Vad Zikna Ani Hu Vad Sevani Esbol. Hashem quotes Yeshaya. Until old age I am he, until old age I will be patient. Hashem says, I am going to create them, the result is going to be okay. If you take a look at source number 26, to condense that into one line, this beautiful Sifri. The Sifri is usually halachic medrash. It's commenting on the line in Parshas Ha'azinu. Kel emunah ve'ein avel. We describe Hashem as kel emunah. Pshat read, God is a God who is enduring. God is a God who is trustworthy. That's not what the Sifri says. Kel emunah, God of faith, sheheemin ba'olam ubara'o. Hashem had faith in the universe, and he created. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks expands on this in Tehillah, Fractured World. Hashem had faith in the universe, and he created it. That's a remarkable idea, right? That Hashem has emunah in us. It actually shows up, when you think about it, the first time that emunah shows up in the Torah. Not the first time the word emunah is used, that I mentioned before. But where is the first case of emunah in the Torah? Way before. Sorry? No, the first case, not where the word is used. The first case of emunah in the Torah. Gan Eden. The first case in the Torah of emunah is Gan Eden. Hashem tells Adam and Chava, there's a tree in the middle of the garden, and I don't want you to eat it. Right? And then he leaves them there. I trust you. He knows how the story is going to turn out, because the whole rest of the Torah is going to have to be rewritten if it turns out differently. But he wants to demonstrate trust. It doesn't work out. They didn't live up to the trust. They ate from the fruit on the first day. And then their story goes along. Chava has two sons, Cain and Hevel. They both bring karbanos. Hashem favors Hevel's karban over Cain's karban. Cain is angry. Hashem gives Cain a speech. He lectures him. He says, look, Cain, you just have to do better. And then he leaves him with Hevel, trusting him. And again, the trust was abrogated because Cain kills Hevel. Now, why should Hevel pay the price for Hashem demonstrating how trusting he is? This is a good question. But my point is, Hashem is trying to teach us a lesson. Hashem is trying to teach us to trust. V'halachta bidrachav. Even when you know that there is going to be a cost, nonetheless, Hashem says, I am still willing to trust, and we should be trusting. So hopefully we'll pick up the lessons of that original Tisha B'Av when we lacked trust in each other. And the devastations of the two Batei Mikdash. It is true, we said it, we saw the sources, there are times when we really are not meant to trust. There are times when you have to say no. There are times when it's inappropriate. But overall, to develop a trusting personality so that that is our default. Better as our default, to be naive and to be over-trusting, to be ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. Thank you.